Random House Audio presents Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops and You by Misha Glenny. Read for you by Jonathan Cowley. Prologue. Crime at 21stcentury.com. In humanity's relentless drive for convenience and economic growth, we have developed a dangerous level of dependency on network systems in a very short space of time. In less than two decades, huge parts of the so-called critical national infrastructure, CNI in geekish, in most countries have come under the control of ever more complex computer systems. Computers guide large parts of our lives as they regulate our communications, our vehicles, our interaction with commerce and the state, our work, our leisure, are everything. At one of several cybercrime trials I have attended in recent years, Britain's Crown Prosecution Service demanded the imposition of a so-called prevention of crime order on a hacker, which would come into force after his release from prison. The order would block him from accessing the internet except for 1 hour a week under the supervision of a police officer. By the time my client completes his sentence, the defendant's lawyer remarked at the hearing, there will barely be a single human activity that will not somehow be mediated by the internet. How is my client supposed to live a normal life under such circumstances? He asked rhetorically. How indeed? Those who have left their mobile phone at home even for a few hours usually notice an intense irritation and a sense of loss, akin to cold turkey among more dependent users. Interestingly, when deprived of the device for 3 days, this corrosive feeling of unease is often replaced by a rush of liberation as one is transported back to a world not so far away, where we neither had nor needed mobile phones and we arranged our lives accordingly. Today, most people feel they cannot live without these tiny portable computers. Perhaps the nearest comparison to computers is the motor vehicle. As cars became a standard family item from the 1940s onwards, only a minority of drivers really understood what was going on under the bonnet. Nonetheless, that was still quite a number who could fix their vehicle whatever the cause of breakdown, still more who could tweak the carburetor in order to limp home, and most could at least change a flat tyre. These days, if it's only a flat tyre, you can still probably reach your destination. But a growing number of breakdowns are now the result of a computer failure in the control box, the black plastic housing usually located behind the engine. If it is a control box issue, then even if you are an experienced tank mechanic, you won't be able to get the car moving. If you are lucky, a computer engineer will be able to fix it, but in most cases you will need to replace the unit. Computer systems are so much more complex and fragile than internal combustion engines that only the very tiniest group of people can begin to deal with a problem beyond the familiar mantra. Have you tried rebooting it? We now find ourselves in a situation where this minuscule elite, call them geeks, technos, hackers, coders, securocrats, or what you will, has a profound understanding of a technology that every day directs our lives more intensively and extensively, while most of the rest of us understand absolutely zip about it. I had first begun to appreciate the significance of this when researching my previous book on global organized crime, McMafia. I travelled to Brazil in order to investigate cybercrime because this absorbing country is, among its many positive qualities, a major centre of bad stuff on the web, though this was little known at the time. Here I met cyber thieves who had engineered a spectacularly successful phishing scam. Phishing remains one of the most dependable pillars of criminality on the internet. There are two simple variants. The victim opens a spam email. The attachment may contain a virus, which enables a computer somewhere else in the world to monitor all activity on the affected computer, including the input of bank passwords. The other trick lies in designing an email that appears to have been sent by a bank or other institution, requesting confirmation of login and password details. If the recipient falls for the ruse, then the spammer can use these to access some or all of your internet accounts. The Brazilian hackers demonstrated step by step how they secured tens of millions of dollars for themselves from bank accounts in Brazil, Spain, Portugal, the United Kingdom, and the United States. I then visited the cyber cops in Brasilia who had busted four other members of their criminal group, although at least twice that number were never tracked down by the police. And then I interviewed the chief of X-Force, the covert operations department of the American computer security company, ISS. In the space of about a week, I realized that conventional or traditional organized crime, colorful and varied though it was, carried with it significantly greater risks for the perpetrators than for those engaged in cybercrime. Old-fashioned organized crime groups, attached to the technology and means of the 20th century, need to overcome two daunting hurdles if they are to make a success of their chosen profession. The police represent their primary business risk. The efficacy of law enforcement varies both geographically and in time. Organized crime groups adapt themselves to these changing conditions and choose one of a number of methods of dealing with the forces of law and order. They can attempt to outmuscle them. They can corrupt them. They can corrupt politicians exercising authority over the police, or they can evade detection. Then they face a second problem: threats posed by the competition, other bad guys trawling for prey in the same waters. Here again, they can attempt to outmuscle them. They can suggest forming an alliance, or they might agree to be absorbed by them. In neither case, however, can the criminal syndicate simply ignore them. That way lies failure, with sometimes fatal results. Key to survival and prosperity is the ability to communicate with your fellow criminals and with the police, and indeed, to send the correct messages to both groups. In Brazil, I learned very quickly that 21st century crime is different. Most importantly, it is much, much harder to identify when people are up to no good on the web. Laws governing the internet vary greatly from country to country. This matters because, in general, a criminal act over the web will be perpetrated from an IP, Internet Protocol address in one country, against an individual or corporation in a second country, before being realized or cashed out in a third. A police officer in Colombia, for example, may be able to identify that the IP address coordinating an assault on a Colombian bank emanates from Kazakhstan. But then he discovers that this is not considered a crime in Kazakhstan, and so his opposite number in the Kazakh capital will have no reason to investigate the crime. Many cyber criminals have the intelligence to research and exploit such discrepancies. I never use American credit or debit cards, one of Sweden's most successful carders told me, because that would put me under the legal jurisdiction of the United States wherever I am on the planet. So I just do European and Canadian cards, and I feel both happy and safe with that. They will never catch me. The divide separating the United States from Europe and Canada is most important, as these are the areas where the highest concentration of cybercrime victims live. The latter territories have much stronger laws enforced to protect individual liberties and rights on the web. Successive US governments have granted greater powers to law enforcement than most European governments would contemplate, allowing officers easier access to data from private companies in the name of fighting crime and terrorism. The implications of this are both profound and, for the moment, impenetrable. Concerns about crime, surveillance, privacy, the accumulation of data by both private and state institutions, freedom of speech, Step Forward WikiLeaks, ease of access to websites, the so-called net neutrality debate, social networking as a political tool, and national security interests constantly bump up against one another in cyberspace. One might argue, for example, that Google's multi-platform, multitasking omnipresence violates the principles of America's antitrust legislation, and that the agglomeration of all that personal data is both an opportunity for criminals and a threat to civil liberties. Yet Google might well respond that the very essence of its genius and success lies in its multi-platform, multitasking omnipresence, and that this in itself promotes America's commercial and security interests. If it wishes, the US government can access Google's data using legal procedures within hours, and because Google gathers data from all over the world, this gives Washington an immense strategic advantage. Other governments should be so lucky. Unlike its Chinese, Russian, or Middle Eastern counterparts, the American government does not need to hack Google to explore its secrets. It can get a court order instead. Would you really give that up in the name of antitrust legislation?
Sample complete. Ready to continue?